Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 36, Self-Emptying. One of my wonderful teachers was a gentleman by the name of James Finley. And James Finley was actually taught by Thomas Merton. Jim summarizes what he learned from Merton by writing, "I looked on Thomas Merton as the living embodiment of the mystical contemplative heritage of my own Christian tradition. The ancient tradition is not simply about believing in Jesus, nor is it simply to live as Jesus lived, a life of love for God and for others. Beyond that, the Christian way is also a life in which we are called to follow Jesus in a process of self-emptying, by which we come to realize that ultimately there is nothing real in us that is less or other than God's infinite love, which is our life. In other words, we are called to realize the mind of Christ, that is, the mind of the boundless oneness of love, knowing that in the end, love alone remains, that God is love, and all that we really are is a manifestation of the eternal love of God." End quote. During his time as Jim's mentor, Merton was going through his own awakening, both to the social justice dimensions of the gospel and to the non-Christian contemplative traditions. Merton was in dialogue with Jews, Sufis, and Hindus who visited him at the monastery. He was particularly interested in an in-depth conversation with the Buddhist. Jim goes on to say, "So taking Merton as my teacher, it was just very natural to me that I could see in the non-Christian contemplative traditions a kind of expansive enrichment on the path of non-dual consciousness of the realization of the mystic way. I got the impression that when we seek what is truest in our own tradition, we discover we are one with those who seek what is truest in their tradition. There is a point of convergence where we meet each other and we recognize each other as seekers of awakening. And what is truest is that we are called to recognize, surrender to, and ultimately be identified with the mystery of God utterly beyond all concepts, all words, all designations whatsoever. What's more, we are to realize that this boundless, birthless, deathless mystery of God is manifesting itself and giving itself to us completely in every breath and heartbeat. If we could really experience all that we really are sitting right here, right now, just the way we are, we'd all experience God loving us into our chair, loving us into the present moment, breath by breath, heartbeat by heartbeat. And then we would bear witness to that realization by the way we treat ourselves, the way we treat others, the way we treat all living things. This is the way. This is the great way." End quote. Jim even suggests that learning from each other's contemplative and religious traditions as Merton did is even more important today than it was when Merton was living. It appears that religions, and perhaps even humanity itself, will not survive if we stay within tribal consciousness, believing our religion is the one true religion. On the surface, our traditions are different, but in their depths, there is a similar tradition of the transformation of the human heart and mind. In Jim's words, "There is the free fall into the boundless abyss of God in which we all meet one another, beyond distinctions, beyond all designations. This is the oneness that includes all distinctions." End quote. I'd like to briefly share with you the story of the Buddha's life so that you have some context for Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's given name is Siddhartha. He was born in India about the year 560 BCE. His father was the king of a clan. He kept Siddhartha sequestered on the palace grounds while he was growing up in order to rear him toward the destiny of kingship. Siddhartha grew up, married, and had a son. Around the time of his son's birth, he finally went into town. On his first visit, he saw an old person. On his second visit, he saw an ill person. And on the third visit, he saw a dead person. He asked his guide if these things happened to everyone. Being assured that they did, Siddhartha became disillusioned and disheartened. He said to himself, "How can I live in these conditions conducive to happiness, knowing that so many of my fellow human beings do not live in these privileged conditions? How can I be happy knowing that they are out there? And how can I myself be happy knowing that all these possessions and all this wealth cannot protect me from illness, old age, and death?" Siddhartha went into town for a fourth visit, and he saw a sadhu, a wandering ascetic monk. The monk, although dressed in rags, radiated an inner peace not dependent upon conditions conducive to happiness. Siddhartha felt a call in his heart for a quest to come to the understanding of the liberation from suffering and come to true and abiding happiness for himself and others. So at around age 29, he left the palace and his family to begin a six-year inner journey. First, he joined a yoga community that practiced deep meditative states. But Siddhartha came to see this as using meditation to evoke certain altered states of consciousness, which is a rarefied version of a life based upon conditioned states. So he joined a wandering group of ascetics who practiced severe fasting. But he became so emaciated and weak that he was in danger of dying. He realized that since his goal was to discover freedom from suffering and the nature of true happiness, things weren't going well. So he started to take food. The other ascetics were scandalized and left him. Then Siddhartha, utterly alone, stopped and calmed himself and looked deeply into the situation. Since his situation was stripped of all superficiality, of all adornment of the extremes of wealth and the extremes of poverty, his situation is our situation. He reveals us to ourselves. He is the human being who has discovered the bankruptcy of the ego's agenda to come to true abiding happiness and fulfillment based on strategies of the ego. He made a vow to himself to sit under a Bodhi tree until he resolved the human dilemma of suffering and the search for inner peace and fulfillment in the midst of life as it is. Through the night, he was tempted by the demon Mara, but he was unshaken in his resolve. He stayed through the night gazing deeply into the bankruptcy of the human life based upon its own strategies. At first light, Siddhartha turned and looked at the day star with awakened eyes as the Buddha, Buddha meaning the one who is awake, seeing life the way it really is, free from all projections, all distortions, all delusions, all strategies, all agendas, all belief systems. He saw, we might say, the boundaryless, trustworthy nature of what is. He sat in the bliss of his enlightenment for many days. Finally, he realized that although many would not be ready to hear his teachings, some would. The Buddha's first words to someone after his enlightenment were, "In this blind world, I beat the drum of deathlessness." So let us take this moment to connect with the boundaryless, trustworthy nature of what is. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Scholar, theologian, and author Marcus Borg, in his marvelous book, Jesus and Buddha, The Parallel Sayings, describes the many amazing similarities in the lives of Jesus and the Buddha, who lived 500 years before Jesus. Borg's explanation for the similarity in their wisdom teaching is that both Jesus and the Buddha had life-transforming experiences of the sacred. Buddha's transformation experience happened under the Bodhi tree. Jesus' transformational initiation happened at his baptism and during the 40 days he then spent in the desert. Both endured temptations by the devil. Both men were around 30 years old at the time of their unitive encounter. We all need such inner experience instead of simple outer belief systems. You need inner experience whereby you can know things to be true for yourself instead of believing them because other people say they are true. This is secondhand religion, or hearsay religion, which is unfortunately the most common variety. There's no belief system in Buddhism. That's why you can be a devout Christian and a devout Buddhist at the same time. The word Dharma, which is what the Buddha spent his life teaching, means law or rule, but not in the sense of dogma. It means the way reality really is. There is no dogma or anything contrary to any Christian dogma in authentic Buddhism. Alongside everything the Buddha said, he also said, "Don't believe it because I said it. Listen to it and check it out for yourself. See if it rings true with your own experience." The West has made an art form out of idealizing the separate individual and trying to make it holy by itself. You need a deep experience of radical participation to break beyond your normal illusion of eco-separateness. Unfortunately, much garden variety Christianity only affirms your separateness and your supposed superiority. Religion was intended to give you an experience of what Owen Barfield calls original participation, or primal unity. Before you are many, you are one. We have so emphasized the many for centuries now that it's very hard for Western people to again experience the one. We are so self-conscious about either our private goodness or our private badness. And worse, the self we are conscious of, the self we are absorbed in, is precisely the self that mystics say does not exist. It's actually our false self. The self that exists, in Christian language, is the communal body of Christ. See 1 Corinthians 12:12. The Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, uses the idea of making cookies to illustrate our confusion about who we really are. Imagine that the moment each cookie leaves the bowl of dough and is placed onto the tray, it begins to think of itself as separate. You, the creator of the cookies, know better, and you have a lot of compassion for them. You know that they are originally all one, and that even now, the happiness of each cookie is still the happiness of all the other cookies. But they have developed discriminating perception, and suddenly they set up boundaries between themselves. Get out of my way. I want to be in the middle. I am brown and beautiful, and you are ugly. Can't you please spread a little in that direction? We have a tendency to behave this way also, and it causes a lot of suffering. If we know how to touch our non-discriminating mind, our happiness and the happiness of others will increase manifold. End quote. This, my friends, is the mind of Christ. 1 Corinthians 2:16. Thich Nhat Hanh continues, "We all have the capacity of living with non-discriminating wisdom, but we have to train ourselves to see in that way, to see the flower is us, the mountain is us, our parents and our children are all us. When we see that everyone and everything belongs to the same stream of life, our suffering will vanish." Non-self is not a doctrine or a philosophy. It is an insight that can help us live life more deeply, suffer less, and enjoy life more. We need to live the insight of non-self, end quote, which, with great irony, we discover to be the one true self. Once you move to the level of participative knowing, you experience the union between us all, and you know that union is more real than the differences. This really is the heart of the matter. Until it becomes a realization that we really are objectively, metaphysically, ontologically more one than many, you are not yet at mysticism 101. It has to be a cellular inner experience. It's something you know by prayer, love, and suffering. It is nothing I can prove to you logically. Paul's explanation of this experience, which Buddhists say is the most Buddhist of all Paul's lines, is, I live no longer, not I, but Christ lives in me, and I in him. Galatians 2:20. That is the experience of the true self, which is already in union with God. This Robert self, this little thing that appears to be visible here and takes itself too seriously, is a relative identity, but it's not my absolute identity that will exist forever. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, according to Buddhism, there are two kinds of truth, relative or worldly truth and absolute truth. He uses wonderful ocean imagery to help us grasp the difference between these truths and between our two selves, the small false self and the true eternal self. When we look at the ocean, we see that each wave has a beginning and an end. A wave can be compared with other waves, and we can call it more or less beautiful, higher or lower, longer lasting or less long lasting. But if we look more deeply, we see that a wave is made of water. While living the life of a wave, it also lives the life of water. It would be sad if the wave did not know that it was water. It would think, someday I will have to die. This period of time is my lifespan, and when I arrive at the shore, I will return to non-being. These notions will cause the wave fear and anguish. We have to help it remove the notions of self, person, living being, and lifespan if we want the wave to be free and happy. A wave can be recognized by signs, high or low, beginning or end, beautiful or ugly. But in the world of the water, there are no signs. In the world of relative truth, the wave feels happy as she swells, and she feels sad when she falls. She may think, I am high, or I am low, and develop a superiority or inferiority complex. But when the wave touches her true nature, which is water, all her complexes will cease, and she will transcend birth and death. We become arrogant when things go well, and we are afraid of falling or being low or inadequate. But these are relative ideas, and when they end, a feeling of completeness and satisfaction arises. Liberation is the ability to go from the world of signs to the world of true nature. We need the relative world of the wave, but we also need to touch the water, the ground of our being, to have real peace and joy, and that is what so many contemporary people lack. We shouldn't allow relative truth to imprison us and keep us from touching absolute truth. Looking deeply into relative truth, we penetrate the absolute. Relative and absolute truths inter-embrace. Both truths, relative and absolute, have a value. Thich Nhat Hanh invites us into contemplative meditative practice wherein we can experience the reality of our union. The deeper level of practice is to lead our daily life in a way that we touch the absolute and the relative truth. In the dimensions of relative truth, the Buddha passed away many years ago, but in the realm of absolute truth, we can take his hand and join him for walking meditation every day. You don't have to physically die to enter nirvana or the kingdom of God. You only have to dwell deeply in the present moment right now. Let us take this moment to dwell deeply in the present moment. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. After his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha sat for some days in his inner liberation, which he called a state of nirvana. As Thich Nhat Hanh explains, nirvana means extinction. First of all, the extinction of all concepts and notions. Our concepts about things prevent us from really touching them. For the Buddha, the ability to see reality as it really is, free of all concepts that distort it, was also the extinction of suffering. Suffering was blown out from within so that it no longer had any footing in his mind or heart. Let's briefly describe the Four Noble Truths that Buddha taught for the rest of his life. The Buddha felt called to share his discovery to help others come to this realization. He found the ascetics that he lived with and told them, "I come to teach the middle way." He embodies the middle way in the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is the truth of suffering. By suffering, the Buddha means a pervasive discontent that the ability to abide in inner peace and fulfillment is elusive. There is a pervasive sense of precariousness. This suffering is the presenting problem. The illness that the Buddha seeks to cure is the propensity for suffering. The second noble truth is that there is a way of life that perpetuates the suffering. There are certain habits of the mind and heart that are perpetuating the very suffering that we seek to be free from. This way of life has its basis in wanting life to be other than the way it is. This is the diagnosis. The third noble truth is that it is possible to be healed from these symptoms by learning to live as one with the way life is. This is the truth of nirvana, the way of abiding peace and equanimity in the rise and fall of daily circumstances just as they are. So this is the hope for the cure, that it is possible to rest in this abiding inner peace and fulfillment. The fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the way of life in which one is liberated from the tyranny of suffering, so that one might come to this nirvanic peace, this inner peace, the peace that passes understanding in the midst of life as it is. What good would it be if the Buddha just pointed out the problem and did not give us a way to be delivered from the problem? That way is the Noble Eightfold Path. Thich Nhat Hanh says the Chinese translated it as the path of eight right practices: right view, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right diligence, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The fourth noble truth is the way out of suffering. First, the doctor looks deeply into the nature of our suffering. Then she confirms that the removal of our pain is possible, and she describes a way out. The way out is the Eightfold Path. The Buddha said again and again, "I teach you only suffering and the transformation of suffering. If you do not transform your pain, you will almost certainly transmit it. And all great religion is about what you do with your pain." The Noble Eightfold Path describes the Buddha's way to transform your pain. The Buddha said, wherever the Noble Eightfold Path is practiced, joy, peace, and insight are there. When the Buddha gave his first sermon to the wandering ascetics, he put into motion the wheel of the Dharma, the way of understanding and love. This teaching is recorded in the Discourse on Turning the Wheel of the Dharma. It teaches us to recognize suffering as suffering and to transform our suffering into mindfulness, compassion, peace, and liberation. The teachings of the Buddha were not to escape from life, but to help us relate to ourselves and the world as thoroughly as possible. The first two steps of the Eightfold Path are right vision and right thinking. Right means effective in evoking happiness and inner peace. These two are associated with the notion of wisdom. They help us ground ourselves in this wisdom of the Eightfold Path. The next four of the eight steps are the paths of the moral precepts. Do not confuse this with being moralistic. The intuition of the Buddha is that one will not come to this inner peace unless one grounds one's life in an inflowing and outflowing love. This is the core of what it means to be moral. Loving is the outflowing way that we must relate to everything. and the outflowing way we must relate to each individual person. On these two commandments hang the entire law and the prophets as well, Jesus says. So right view and right thinking are the wisdom aspects of the Eightfold Path, but right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right diligence are the life of effort and choice that expands our realm of conscious freedom. God cannot and will not give us any gift that we do not want or freely choose, usually again and again. The last two steps are right mindfulness and right concentration. The Buddha felt none of this would work without deep meditative practice. I also find that a meditation practice is necessary for transformation, except for people who allow themselves to be changed through great love or great suffering. Meditation then preserves and sustains what they have learned in love and suffering over the long haul. In other words, I know many meditators who are still quite self-absorbed people, and I have met people who do not even know the word meditation, who live in deep unitive consciousness. There is no one technique. Life and death itself are the only technique. Let us take this moment to meditate together. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The practice this week is Tonglen. The practice of Tonglen is a way of holding suffering and awakening compassion. In order to have compassion for others, we have to have compassion for ourselves. In particular, to care about other people who are fearful, angry, jealous, overpowered by addictions of all kinds, arrogant, proud, selfish, mean, you name it, to have compassion and to care for these people means not to run from the pain of finding these things in ourselves. Instead of fending it off and hiding from it, one could open one's heart and allow oneself to feel the pain. Feel it as something that will soften and purify us and make us far more loving and kind. The Tonglen practice is a method for connecting with suffering, ours and that which is all around us, everywhere we go. It is a method for overcoming fear of suffering and for dissolving the tightness of our heart. Primarily, it is a method for awakening the compassion that is inherent in all of us, no matter how cruel or cold we might seem to be. We begin the practice by taking on the suffering of a person we know to be hurting and who we wish to help. For instance, if you know of a child who is being hurt, you breathe in the wish to take away all the pain and fear of that child. Then, as you breathe out, you send the child happiness, joy, or whatever would relieve the pain. This is the core of the practice, breathing in others' pain so they can be well and have more space to relax and open, and breathing out, sending them relaxation or whatever you feel would bring them relief and happiness. However, we often cannot do this practice because we come face to face with our own fear, our own resistance, anger, or whatever our personal pain, our personal stuckness happens to be at the moment. At this point, you can change the focus and begin to do Tonglen for what you are feeling and for millions of others just like you who are at the very moment of time are feeling exactly the same stuckness and misery. Maybe you are able to name your pain. You recognize it clearly as terror or revulsion or anger or wanting to get revenge. So you breathe in for all the people who are caught with the same emotion, and you send out relief or whatever opens up the space for you or whatever opens up the space for yourself and all those countless others. Maybe you can't name what you're feeling, but you can feel it. A tightness in the stomach, a heavy darkness, or whatever. Just contact what you are feeling and breathe in. Take it in for all of us and send out relief to all of us. You can do Tonglen for all the people who are just like you. For everyone who wishes to be compassionate but instead is afraid. For someone who wishes to be brave but instead is a coward. Breathe in for all of us and breathe out for all of us. Use what seems like poison as medicine. Use your personal suffering as the path to compassion for all beings. Thank you for being with me. May your self-emptying be the path to compassion for all beings. Blessings to all.